welcome to Worlds Apart. With the war in Ukraine and the pummeling of Gaza usurping most of the airtime, the world has been almost oblivious to the violence in Sudan, which is said to be the worst displacement and humanitarian crisis in the world at this very moment. Efforts to mediate it have produced few results and at times smacked of extortion. What or who can bring it to a close? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Amjad Farid Al-Tayeb, Executive Director at FIKRA for Studies and Development, a Sudanese think tank. Dr. Al-Tayeb, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you, Oksana, and thank you for taking the time and interest in addressing what's happening in Sudan.
Now, I've seen some estimates suggesting that the scale of violence, suffering, and destruction in Sudan eclipses both the war in Ukraine and the conflict in Gaza combined, and yet it receives significantly less attention, both from the media and from the international community. What do you think explains that?
What's happening in Sudan is by all means the worst political argumentarian crisis of our times. Like we are talking about almost 26 million people who are in their humanitarian need, and we are talking about 12 million displaced and refugees to the neighboring countries. We are talking about 9 million children outside of schools, 19 million students, both combined in schools and university, who have their study cut. It is the worst humanitarian crisis. And also to touch upon the sexual violence, the rape, the torture, the sexual slavery being committed and practiced as the norm of the RSF military tactics, and you add to that the worst famine that witnessed by the world in the last 50 years. But as you correctly said, there is very little attention from the world or political will to resolve the situation. This lies on many things, but the major reason, I think, is competing narrative about the war in Sudan. There is a narrative that's being broadcasted by foreign powers, particularly the UAE, United Arab Emirates, which try to justify the RSF war in Sudan as war against the Islamists and war against the military regime, and an attempt to install democratic and civilian rule in Sudan. This is completely an attempt to cover and whitewash the crimes committed by the RSF in service of the UAE agenda.
I also want to mention something that one high-ranking UN official said about it. She said that this conflict is being ignored due to the so-called psychic numbing, where people feel more apathetic towards a tragedy as the death toll continues to climb. And to some extent, I think that's understandable. People around the world have their own lives to attend to, but we have special agencies, we have special institutions like the aforementioned UN to deal with those issues. They have the expertise, they have the resources. At this point of time, how would you assess their involvement and their response to this ongoing emergency?
The UN system, whether humanitarian or political, have been a failure for some time, particularly in Sudan. The UN failed to support the transition in Sudan, the democratic transition after the revolution, the popular revolution in 2019, toppled the Islamist and the Islamic dictator Omar al-Bashir. The UN failed, and the international community as a whole failed, to support the transition to maintain a stable democratic transition. And this led to a coup in which the two currently warring parties were allies to topple the civilians, and then they start fighting among themselves in 2023. The international community has too many competing interests, and the UN is failing to show leadership on these too many initiatives and interventions that attempt to address the situation in Sudan.
Dr. Al-Tayeb, can I just clarify something that you just said, that the international community failed to support the civilian transition in Sudan? What exactly do you have in mind? Because you also have been critical unwilling to accept any kind of foreign intervention. So what measures do you think the UN should have taken to make this civilian transition? By the way, you work for that civilian government yourself, to make it more stable and to help it take roots in a country that has been, let's admit, brutalized by violence for many years.
Actually, yes, I work as assistant chief of staff during the transition to the prime minister during the transition. And I can tell you firsthand that the international community was ignoring the too many challenges faced by the newly formed civilian government and just selling words without selling the talk, without walking the walk. The U.S. government continued to impose the sanction based on the designation of Sudan as state sponsor of terrorism for almost 2 years after the Sudanese people by themselves without help from the West managed single-handedly to bring down one of the worst Islamist dictatorships in the world and in Africa. And after that, they were anticipating some sort of support from the international community to help stabilizing the civilian lead of the government. However, the U.S. decided at the time to blackmail Sudan to signing the Abraham Accord in exchange of de-sanctioning or delisting the name of Sudan. After the coup in 2021, the UN, the AU, and the IGAD, which is the intergovernmental agency of the countries in East Africa, they formed a trilateral mechanism in an attempt to reverse the coup. However, the US and UK, together with Saudi Arabia and Emirates, they actually sidelined this trilateral and took things to their own hands, and they start picking and choosing how to cuddle the military factions that throw the coup, which led to feeding their ambitions for power and ended with the current war.
Now, how do you understand the interest of those belligerent forces, the military on one side and the paramilitary grouping? What are they fighting for at the moment? Because from what I know, the Sudanese economy is in collapse. Farmers cannot do their jobs. Half of the population is facing acute food insecurity. Are there any resources, apart from the heavily brutalized population, to be fighting over?
There is no analysis of what are the interests. There is an interest of many countries to control many of the resources in Sudan. This starts with the gold, which Sudan have been very rich in gold mining. That's been and the gold trade is being monopolized and unregulated and monopolized by parties that has connection to Emirates, especially to the gold market in Dubai. And also the geopolitical position of Sudan that controls over 700 miles of its shores in the Red Sea, which is the biggest trade route in the globe. Also, it's also a major resource is the wealth of the agricultural land. UAE and other countries, including China, they tried for a very long time what we can call land banking, land grabbing and banking, just to take the land for 99 years and not utilize it, or even if utilize it, to utilize it in a very exploitive manner without allowing any grassroots development to the communities. And this made the communities, of course, obstruct a lot of these projects. So basically, I think land, water, gold, and position are the main things that makes a lot of the superpower in the globe, not the superpower and the baby powers who want to be superpowers as well, competing over Sudan.
At this point of time, do you believe that any civilian government can manage the situation on its own? And what kind of help, can we be concrete, what kind of help you think would be the best for your country?
I think it's not any civilian government. I think it's a civilian government to take over in the country is a must. We need to understand one thing between about this war. This war is happening with between two bad actors, but one of them is far much worse than the other. But both SAF and the RSF, both the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces, were partners just a few years ago in a coup together against the civilians. And then SAF lost control over RSF, and RSF fed the fascist and ambition of its leaders, and they turned into their failed coup on the 15th of April. 2023, backed by foreign powers, particularly the UAE, and led to this war. So without actual and serious reform within the army and a dismantling process of the RSF as an institution, there would be no way and no future for stability, let alone democracy in Sudan. What the international community can do? Fair is the international community need to stop doing further harm. The superficial and misguided intervention that try to address the interest of other powers and set a blind eye on the atrocities committed by certain parties, particularly the RSF, is allowing institutional impunity for actors who destabilizing the country more and more.
We have to take a very short break, but I promise you to return back to this very pressing issue of the foreign intervention in your country. So stay with us. We will be back in just a couple of moments.
Польша не вошла в состав Золотой Орды. И это очень важная особенность, очень серьезный водораздел в истории Польши и в истории России.
Польша была абсолютно списана со счетов истории. Ну, было какое-то государство, не будет его, это будут исконно германские территории.
Советский Союз начал оказывать помощь Польше уже в годы войны. Только в одну лишь освобожденную Варшаву из голодного Советского Союза, который тоже был разрушен, где люди голодали, было направлено 60 тысяч тонн хлеба, 100 тонн сахара и 50 тонн сухофруктов. Это была просто бескорыстная братская помощь польскому народу.
Достаточно послушать, что говорит министр обороны Польши. Говорит, что мы готовы к войне. Говорит, что нам надо покупать новые ракеты, покупать вертушки, покупать подлодки. Все это как будто под видом самообороны. Но для меня это подготовка к чему-то страшному.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Amjad Farid Altayeb, Executive Director at FIKRA for Studies and Development, the Sudanese think tank. Now, Dr. Altayeb, I do want to discuss foreign intervention, but before we go there, let me ask you specifically about the claims of the Arab supremacist ideology that's said to be running high within both warring factions. I'm not an expert here, so I'm asking for your opinion here. I've heard that there are a certain set of Arab commanders, especially with the paramilitary force, who have a fascist or supremacist Arab ideology, some of them hailing from the Western Darfur region. And there are even reports that some of them believe that this is sort of their land, that everybody else has to be driven out and that, you know, they're the sole rightful owners of that place. Is that true?
It's true, but it's more complicated than that. I think when you use the term you use is to describe the ideology of the RSF is the right term. They are fascist group, and ethnic supremacy is part of the defining characteristics of fascism. But this ethnic supremacy is being used as a factor to cover other interests. RSF is a mafia-style militia. What they want is to gather resources, control the country, control the land. And while they are doing this, they are using the ethnic politics as a recruiting tactic, as a recruiting matter to recruit people from certain ethnic groups to join their ranks. But during this, they committed, of course, ethnic cleansing. They committed mass atrocities and mass killing against the Al-Masalit in Al-Jinina in May and June 2023, against the Zaghawa, which are all African Darfuri tribes. They committed this mass killing and supremacy against them. But they committed the same atrocities and mass killing against other tribes and against people from Arab descendants in other areas in Sudan, like what's happening in Al Jazeera. And for the last 3 weeks, in less than 3 weeks, the RSF killed almost 2,000 people in Al Jazeera in central Sudan who are from Arab descent. So what I'm saying is that there are ethnic factors used by the paramilitary RSF militia, but they are using it as a tactic rather than a genuine belief.
Now, I read that there are also cases of atrocities and ethnic cleansing being committed by the army side as well. So none of them is particularly an attractive civil force to lead the country into the future. Now, recently,
100%, Aksana, I have to point to something here, because yes, the army, nobody is defending the army. The state apparatus in Sudan has a lot to fix and reform. But I'm challenging this news that you refer to about SAF committing ethnic-based crimes. Because when you look at the composition of the leadership of SAF itself, you find generals from Nuba Mountain, generals from Darfur, generals from Blue Nile, in addition to generals from Central Sudan. This narrative, this misinformation, which is deliberate and big, and I believe that you likely had your resources in a reputable platform, but it tells you about the extent of the misinformation and disinformation campaign. We have a problem, a war between two bad actors. Well, one of them is worse than the other. But as an attempt from certain mainstream political groups and mainstream media to cover how bad is the other factor, they use misinformation and disinformation like this. On May last year, when the war erupted and reports about the rape and the sexual violence start to happen, that what was called the civilian front, which now transformed into Taqaddum Alliance, that's led by Dr. Abdullah Hamdok, the former prime minister, issued a statement about rape cases, five rape cases committed or took place in Omdurman, in certain area in Omdurman, which is part of the capital Khartoum. In order to have their statement balanced, they said like two were committed by the RSF and three of these cases were committed by SAF. While it was public knowledge at that time that all these cases were committed by the RSF, but it was an attempt from them to distribute the blame. Of course, there was a public outcry, and this public outcry forced that civilian front to withdraw that statement and apologize about it. But it reflected and showed this tactic of misinformation on distributing the blame. This is not just a political maneuver. This affects the protection of civilians. This affects the livelihood and safety of the people. In order to protect the people from the atrocities of these wars and from the horrors and terrors of this war, we need to define exactly where the risks are coming from. When you're just trying to claim that you are neutral by distributing the blame of the crimes like this, you are giving the flagrant impunity to continue doing the bad things that they are doing.
I think it also shows that the failed statehood is a very complex phenomenon, and you truly need to think very carefully and deliberately about how to lead a country through that very precarious transition, that simply having a civilian government is not enough. There should be indeed an organized effort, both by the local society, but also by the neighbors, well-wishing neighbors, and perhaps other actors to help that very vulnerable and precarious process to go on, rather than leaving it on its own and exploiting it for various geopolitical or economic reasons. Now that we have come to the point of discussing foreign intervention, you mentioned before the role of the United Arab Emirates being very critical, accusing it of funneling weapons to the paramilitary groups. How do you understand the Emirates' interest at this point? What are they trying to achieve there?
I'm not the one who's accusing them. It's the UN itself. We had in the beginning of this year, in January 2024, a report issued by the independent experts, by the UN independent expert to Darfur, pointing fingers directly to UAE for breaching the UN resolution 1591 that banned the weapon transfer to Sudan. And after that, we had like dozens of independent reports from different media outlets documenting the continuous support and the continuous blame and lifeline of supply of weapons to the RSF in Darfur. These weapons are being used to kill the Sudanese people. More recently, there is also reports of Israel sending the RSF advanced air defense weapons and frameworks through other countries that's related to the Abraham Accord to the RSF. What I'm seeing is in an attempt is a crime of aggression by UAE that starts supporting the RSF since day one. And in the same time, they are trying to use their diplomatic influence to force themselves as a mediator or a neutral actor. And for that, they are pulling the strings with the UAE, with the USA, with the UN, and they are using some sort of diplomatic of humanitarian diplomacy.
Dr. Altaib, how do you understand their interest? Because I'm very skeptical of various independent or UN reports. I mean, I used to be a war reporter in Libya and Syria, and I know how these documents are composed. They're hardly independent. But since you are an expert and you definitely have an interest in the well-being of your country, how do you understand all those foreign interventions? Because it's not only the United Arab Emirates and not only Israel. You know that Russia, too, has been accused in Western media of supporting the paramilitary force. So I want to understand why those nations are said or are indeed involving themselves in that matter.
I think both Russia, UAE, and Israel, they all have interest in the wealth in Sudan. Israel, basically, because of the geolocation and what Burhan, the leader of SAF, gave them, which was aviation rights to cross the Sudan airspace. As I said, UAE is looking at the agricultural land at the Red Sea shores of Sudan. And in addition to the gold, Russia have been also known to be very much involved in the gold smuggling from Sudan. And by the way, Russia is not only supporting the RSF. Russia is playing both sides of the war. They have their relationship with SAF, and they have their relationship with the RSF through the Wagner Group which is less connected, at least officially, to the Russian...
Wait a second, because this is a very serious allegation. Wagner Group is a private group that staged last year, that staged a coup against the Russian government. I mean, there were Russian servicemen that were killed in that coup. So it was a very shady story, and it's true that the Russian government relied on their services, both in Ukraine and I think perhaps in some other places as well. But it is clear, it is also clear that the Kremlin does not issue orders to Wagner. Wagner can oppose Kremlin very strongly. So when you say that Russia is involved on both sides, is it the Russian nationals that you mean? Or are you actually, you know, do you actually have in mind the Kremlin, the official Russian government who is trying to, you know, pull the strings in your country?
The Kremlin, of course, as a representative of the formal state apparatus in Russia, is keeping its relationship with the formal state apparatus in Sudan, represented in SAF. But as well, the Kremlin has other hands, which, as you know, as you very much know, after the coup of Wagner, which some people may be state, as Wagner Group was rebranded as African troops, and they continue to have some relation or service.
Absolutely, they have business, extensive business ties in Africa. That's true. I'm not sure
in Central Africa, in Central Africa,
yes, as many other nations,
And I'm talking here. No, I'm not talking about nations. I'm talking about the Wagner Group, which has a very complicated and maybe with ups and downs relationship with the Russian government. But let's not forget that Sergei Lavrov, in few weeks before the war, when he was in Sudan, he publicly defended the Wagner involvement in Sudan, and they are saying that they are helping in fighting terrorism and stabilizing the country. So basically, this was the Russian foreign affairs minister in my country saying that the Wagner Group, that was known for training and supplying and strategizing with a militia that just 2 months later initiated a war, was defended by Lavrov.
As you, I'm sure, well know, security in Africa is a very precarious matter, and there indeed requests for private contracting services coming to Wagner or perhaps some other officials from various African groups or African nations. That in and of itself does not, I think, prove that Russia in some matter supports terrorism or the violence against your country. I think, if anything, I think it would benefit from, you know, normalizing the relationship, because as you pointed out, it also may have interest in the, you know, warm water port, etc. But since we have to finish our conversation, I want to ask you one last question. What would you like Russia and any other interested nations to do at this point of time, given the level of violence? What could help at this point of time to the people on the ground, not the various factions, but the people who are still suffering?
All the interventions that's happening towards Sudan right now from foreign powers, and that's trying to serve different interests, are harmful. What we need, the international community, is to impose its legitimacy. Fair is to stop UAE of the continuous support to the RSF, and this is a must. This is the easiest and quickest way to stop the war in Sudan. The war would not have continued if the UAE have stopped supplying the weapons and the supplies to the RSF to kill people in El Fasher, in Guinea, in Khartoum, in Jazeera, in everywhere. The second is for the Western in general, and also for the Eastern camp, if this is the right term in referring to Russia, to stop picking and choosing who to support from the Sudanese civilians or from the Sudanese political actors. The Sudanese people are the only ones who have the right to choose who represents them. The West have supported the Takaddum Alliance that's being warned and funded by the Western, and now it is in service of the Emiratis and the RSF agenda, and the Russian as well have their allies on the other side. We need this through intervention to stop. The war needs to stop for the collective benefit of the Sudanese people, not for the political and partisan agenda of certain political elites or foreign interests.
Okay, Dr. Altaf, we have to leave it there, but I strongly side with your point of view that the war needs to stop for the benefit of the people. Thank you very much for being with us, and hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.